This is New Books in Intellectual History. I'm Ray Haberski, one of the hosts, and today I did an interview with Molly Worthen, who's an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she's the author most recently of Apostles of Reason, The Crisis of Authority in American Evangelicalism. This book takes a look at 70 years of evangelical history in the United States, but primarily is concerned with the ideas that move different debates, everything from Carl Henry and Christianity Today up through the culture wars and Francis Schaeffer and folks like that. Molly Worthen is a really fine writer. The book is very well written, very well organized, has a lot of colorful characters, but most importantly, I think it is a model for how to do very good intellectual and religious history and how to integrate those two types of history with biography. So this is a good interview. Molly Worthen had a lot of fascinating things to say, and I think folks who are interested in sort of contemporary or more recent American history will find her book well worth the read. Hello, Molly Worthen. Welcome to New Books Intellectual History.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on this show, on this podcast. The book that we're going to be talking about today is Apostles of Reason, The Crisis of Authority in American Evangelicalism. It is, however, your second book. So I was wondering if you could start off by telling us a little bit about your background, perhaps where you come from, your academic background, and the first book that you wrote.
I'm happy to. I grew up in the Midwest outside of Chicago, and my first book has its origins in my college experience. It's a somewhat unconventional book that I stumbled into. I took a course as an undergraduate at Yale University with John Gaddis, who's a historian of Cold War history, and the course was called The Art of Biography. Uh-huh. And for this course, I wrote a final paper that was a biographical essay about a professor that I had as an undergraduate who fascinated me and many of my peers because he had come only lately to academe. He had spent 40 years as a foreign service officer, and no one has heard of him. His name is Charles Hill. He was kind of a behind-the-scenes guy, but behind the scenes at very interesting points in the history of American foreign policy. He was a speechwriter for Henry Kissinger. He served in the Saigon embassy at the tail end of America's involvement there. During the Reagan administration, he was second in command in the State Department, and was a voluminous note taker. He took contemporaneous notes during his time at the highest level of the State Department of every conversation that he witnessed or heard.
Wow.
He produced about 25,000 pages of notes, verbatim notes, covering only 6 years.
Oh my
God. He had notes also from earlier parts of his career as well. And no one had ever seen these because they were confiscated by the FBI in the course of the Iran-Contra investigation. But Charlie had made contraband photocopies, I convinced him to let me use them.
Yeah.
And so this project snowballed, and I ended up pursuing it as my senior essay in my last year of college, and then as a book project. And it kind of expanded and became not only a window into American foreign policy through the experience of this individual, but also a very personal biography. I got to know his ex-wife, and I wrote about the conflicts between personal and professional demands, and also about my own experience as a student of his who had begun really admiring him and then come to see that he was a human who had made poor decisions and done things I didn't approve of. Meeting someone's ex-wife has a way of showing you that they have feet of clay. And then coming full circle to a point where I really do still admire a lot of what he did. And for me, the project was a bit of a detour intellectually. I had started out my college education with interest in religious history and then taken this detour in diplomatic history. And when it came time to consider what I wanted to do next, I returned to the study of religion. But I do see some continuities between that first book, which is called The Man on Whom Nothing Was Lost, and my most recent book, in that both are, broadly speaking, about the role that ideas play in people's lives and the appeal of a comprehensive worldview, a grand strategy.
Yeah.
And secondly, I would add that both are about education, and they're about what's involved in critical inquiry and how we teach that process, how we negotiate it, and the appeal of a very powerful intellectual authority, but also the hazards of navigating that. And so, you know, in retrospect, I see that even though it seems as if my most recent book, which is about American evangelicals, is a total departure, that in some ways I've been pursuing the same questions.
I think it's fascinating because unlike, I think, most history majors in an undergraduate institution, you actually came to a history of biography, a theoretical view on history, I think a lot faster, a lot sooner than most do, which is really interesting. Can you talk a bit about that?
It's funny. I don't know that I was aware of it. I was not very thoughtful about my method, certainly as an undergraduate, and probably only came to it late as I was pressed to consider these questions more seriously in my graduate education. But I certainly think, like all students, I imbibed the assumptions of my teachers. And John Gaddis was certainly a big influence on me. And while he's interested in questions that are not so much the questions I take up now in my more recent scholarship, he's someone who takes ideas very seriously and seeks to really occupy the minds of his subjects. He modeled that core historian's goal of radical empathy, of setting aside your own assumptions and really trying to understand the world from your subject's point of view. And certainly, I learned to focus on that long before I was consciously reading any theoretical literature or thinking about methodologies. And I'm grateful for that because I think that basic project of empathy is really the most important thing. It's certainly the key task that I try to communicate to my students, and it's what I try to do in all my scholarship.
That's great stuff. I mean, the idea of biography is quite central to this book on evangelicals. But I'm also interested in sort of, because I almost get a sense reading that book that, like your first book on Charles Hill, you do have a relationship with the people that you study, that you feel their personality in some way. And I'm curious about this because I think one of the most difficult things to teach students is that while we can read people in journals and in their books and even, you know, get a sense of them from oral interviews, they are full people with problems and concerns, and they have families. Can you tell us a bit more about in regard to Charles Hill, how you developed the sort of relationship with him as a historical subject who was fully formed after a while to you?
Writing about Charlie was a task unlike anything I had certainly done before and have done since, and presented unique challenges as far as writing an objective biography. First of all, I was starting out as his student, and so in some regard I was at a disadvantage. I was young. I mean, when I first began peppering him with questions and reading his notes, I was, gosh, I guess I would have been 20.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a lot of seasoning.
Yeah.
But he, you know, he is a controversial teacher at Yale, to be honest. But in this regard, in regard to my project, I think he saw its potential before I did. And he was very professional about it from the beginning and made it clear to me that he would submit to as many hours of interview as I wanted. Eventually, he gave me full access to really every scrap of paper he'd ever produced, which he has deposited in an archive out at the Hoover Institution at Stanford.
Right.
And he said that he would simply follow my lead, and there was no question that was off limits. In fact, he strikes me as a person who was simply born without the gene for embarrassment.
That's
and
amazing.
Truly, was willing to talk very candidly about his relationship with his ex-wife, for example, in a way that put me in something of a bind as a historian writing about people who are largely still alive.
Yeah.
I found very graphic notes that he had kept about the final months of his first marriage, that, you know, about personal fights and really quite terrible stuff. And it was really a dilemma for me, how much of this to include, if any, how to handle
it.
Because,
yeah.
Right. And, you know, I tried to reach a happy medium, and mm-hmm. in which I included enough as I believe was necessary to tell the story without being salacious. But certainly, I got to know him from several angles. I had the luxury of writing about a living subject, so I could test the conclusions I was drawing from the documents against his own recollections and interpretations. But of course, that's a dicey business as well, because as we know, the human memory is not necessarily very reliable. And I couldn't necessarily treat his own account as an always valid correction on my own interpretations.
Yeah.
So I simply try to cross-check as much as possible and account for any discrepancies and be very forthright about my own perspective. And at the encouragement of my editor, I ended up writing about a third of that book in the first person, reflecting about my own experiences with Charlie, my changing view of him, and my experience in the classroom and observing him teaching in other contexts to make it clear to the reader that this was kind of an unusual situation and really all the more interesting for its unique features.
I think that a bridge between that early, really extraordinary project and the one that you've just come up with this new book, is that you are sensitive to the fact that the people you write about, the evangelicals you write about, you don't caricature them. You don't try to put them into boxes that people already want them to fit into. I mean, there's this real sense, as I read through the book, of an arc to the overall story, to arcs within people's lives, to arcs within movements. It's really very well done, and I have a sense that it's because of this early experience that you are able to be sensitive to the way that people live their lives through ideas that they truly believe in, which I don't think all historians are able to do all that well. And I think you do a really nice job with that. So maybe you could talk now a bit about some of the people who you found fascinating when looking back at 70 years of American evangelical history, and why you picked out particular people as sort of representative figures or that were particularly interesting to you as you went through this history.
Well, thanks very much. That's very generous of you. I do think, I mean, maybe I fall into the other hazard of taking ideas too seriously sometimes, but certainly I think that all human beings, whether they are particularly educated or not, whether they're very articulate in the way we normally expect or not, they're all creatures of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And also, a point I always make to my students is that there's not a straight line between theology or ideology and lived experience. The two constantly change and inform one another in this very complicated dialectic. But I did find that the most interesting way to tell the story of, frankly, sometimes quite abstract ideas is to focus on characters and real human beings as much as possible.
Yep.
Early on, I got very interested in a figure who's fairly well known to historians of evangelicalism, and that's Carl Henry,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the founding he was the founding editor in chief of the magazine Christianity Today, and really I think that the leader in this intellectual vanguard of self-described neo-evangelicals who wanted to bring conservative Protestantism out of the fundamentalist wilderness and back into conversation with mainstream intellectual life, and I found him compelling. Because, I had fairly rich access to his interior life, I think, through the records of Christianity Today magazine.
Okay.
And I admired his ambition and his vision for the institutions he was building, not just Christianity Today, but also Fuller Theological Seminary, the Evangelical Theological Society, various evangelistic projects he was involved in abroad, and his conviction that spiritual revival was inseparable from intellectual revival. His story also helped me trace the genealogy of this particular strand of evangelicalism that I argue in the book became influential out of all proportion to its numerical representation among conservative Protestants in America, and that is this sort of post-fundamentalist, reformed, heavily reformed expression of Protestantism that Carl Henry encountered in his education, starting at Wheaton College and further on, engaging with a particular school of epistemology that taught him to focus on the presuppositions, the assumptions that underlie a person's worldview and their importance in framing all argument.
Yeah.
And his colleagues' ability to package this theory of epistemology and really broadcast it through the institutions they found is crucial for what I call the really intellectual backstory of the rise of the Christian right. At the same time, he was a very human, flawed guy, and
right.
I came across correspondence among his colleagues complaining about him,
right.
complaining about the size of his ego,
yep.
how he was always putting his own career in front of the magazine, and you know, reading his own memoirs, I was fascinated by his encounters with Karl Barth and
yes.
his simultaneous pride and insecurity, and he came off the page for me. Another figure that I really set out to capture quite early in my research was John Howard Yoder.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that, too. Yeah, he's fascinating.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, he's probably the most prominent Mennonite, American Mennonite theologian of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
I would say, and was someone who was in conversation with Carl Henry as a young man. Yoder was a bit younger, I think about a decade or more younger than Henry. And we don't commonly think of Mennonites as evangelicals. And the Mennonites themselves
right.
often reject that term. They're typically not corralled into that conversation, into most histories of evangelicalism. But I very much wanted to include them because I do see Mennonites as in the same conversation as the self-appointed mainstream of evangelicalism represented by people like Billy Graham and Carl Henry. And Yoder is a great example. Yoder is someone who grew up in an established Mennonite community in Ohio, was trained in all Mennonite institutions until he went to Europe for his studies, but took up a correspondence, began a correspondence with Carl Henry while he was a graduate student in Europe.
Yeah.
And in kind of contesting Henry's assumptions about the need to define Protestant orthodoxy in terms of rationalistic truth claims,
right.
and really pushing back against Henry's fundamentalist hangover, we might say.
Yeah, pretty bold.
Yoder always used the first person plural. He always
yeah.
said, we
yeah.
need to consider this. We need to look at this history and consider the limitations of the fundamentals for today's problems. And he very much thought of himself as, I think, an evangelical, but also as a witness
yes.
to other evangelicals,
yes.
someone whose burden it was to represent the Anabaptist tradition, the peace witness, and the Anabaptist view of matters like biblical inspiration,
yeah.
which had a lot to offer, I think, in the context of the confrontation between traditional Protestant orthodoxy and modernity.
I was going to say, I mean, one of the things that Yoder seems to be able to do for you in this book is to bring together the sort of the idea that while ideas are important, it's there isn't one way to sort of get at them or to make arguments that are convincing, that there has to be something sort of flesh and blood behind them, somebody willing to take almost irrational action to show their undeterred faith in the ideas that they're putting out there, and that it doesn't depend on the rest of the intellectual world to accept them for them to be right to you. And Yoder seemed to be sort of this voice in the wilderness at times, but he is somebody that you follow all throughout the book, and in some ways he becomes more prominent certainly near the end of his life, even after, right? Because of
I think that's right.
Yeah.
He models, he certainly has come to model for young evangelicals a countercultural
yeah.
Christian alternative, a way of being Christian that is not Jerry Falwell or
right.
the moral majority.
But also
and,
not liberal
know,
in that way, not Niebuhr, not, you know, sort of the mainstream New Republic nation, argument about whatever, anti-war or pro-poor people, something like that. This is the third way, an alternative to all this.
That's right. His book, The Politics of Jesus, has remained in print and remained, I mean, for a work of Protestant scholarship, really, a mini bestseller for decades since it was published in the early 70s for just that reason. And you're right that, that Yoder did not have the same, I think, insecurity and deep anxiety for approval and inclusion by the mainstream that Henry had. But on the other hand, he was coming out of that while it had its struggles with fundamentalism, perhaps had always retained a closer connection to its roots. And certainly, coming out of the Anabaptist tradition, Yoder had less anxiety about, being part of the conversation in the lofty reaches of German theology that someone like Carl Henry would have had. But you're right. He's been rediscovered, and his appeal has broadened precisely because he had the relationship between ideas and culture.
Yeah. Okay, so we get back to Carl Henry. Can you tell us a little bit about how Henry becomes, what he imagines he wants to become in terms of American religious, either intellectuals or American religious leaders? Because he seems to play off against Billy Graham, who I have to say it's really interesting in your book where Graham fits in, because if you're writing a book, you're telling somebody you're writing a book about American evangelicals, Graham would be front and center in almost every chapter. But that's not the case in your book, which I found really well done. So can you tell us a little bit more about Henry and his relationship to Graham?
You're right. I think that Graham has become this shorthand for all of American evangelicals, and certainly he is the main figurehead of this self-appointed cadre of neo-evangelicals who really seek to represent evangelicalism to the world, to both the towers of political power, but also intellectual circles. Henry's interests were, from the beginning, I think, more intellectual. Henry was very committed to evangelism and involved in some of the big evangelistic conferences that Graham was also part of in Berlin in 1966, for example, and certainly the massive Lausanne conference in 1974. But these were as much evangelical ecumenical projects as they were about evangelism. They were not crusades in the sense that we associate with Billy Graham. I think Henry and Graham had much in common, and certainly I don't believe that Graham disapproved of anything that Henry was up to. It was simply that Henry saw the mission to convert the world to Christ as connected inextricably to a project about reforming intellectual culture and reasserting the ideas of conservative Protestant dogma to really the center of at least conversation in American intellectual circles. And he believed stridently in the power of theology to shape culture. And his gifts simply lay elsewhere. So if you want to get at the story of how it is that we arrive in the late 1970s and early 1980s and we have this ascendant Christian right that represents a certain political platform, to really understand where that comes from, you have to dig underneath that and uncover the intellectual foundations and the theology that perhaps is unstated but informs that agenda, and to trace the genealogy of that. It's really Henry's story that reveals it rather than Billy Graham's.
So just so we don't get too far ahead in this, before I get you to define sort of the central conflict of the book, could you tell me what that is? How did Henry identify a conflict that Graham maybe he didn't care quite as much about because he saw his work in sort of missionary work, but Henry saw a different type of conflict that he had to be attentive to in American intellectual life. How would you describe that?
Well, I would say that both Graham and Henry were concerned with the authority of the Bible over modern life.
Okay.
And certainly Graham was part of the founding of Christianity Today, for example, and most of the other organizations that I mentioned in connection with Henry. But yes, you're right in that Henry saw his battlefields a little bit differently, and I think in the context of the Cold War age of ideology, in which every every intellectual seemed to have an ism to explain the world, to account for the course of history, to explain the tremendous suffering and human evil, really, that the 20th century had witnessed by the time of the mid-1950s. Henry saw the need for a conservative Protestant ism, an all-encompassing worldview that would stand up to the threats of modern secular ideology and could offer the same compelling explanations that Marxism could, or that he felt secular liberals were offering, although they were less ideological and, in his view, I think far more inconsistent.
Right.
And that was really his project.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something here that I sometimes see in debates among Catholics at this time, is that there's a relationship that that different Christian churches have to the state or to the nation or to the sort of mythic understanding of America. It's certainly the imperative changes because of the Cold War, but they sort of reserve that they are independent of the state, of the nation, of America, because they see this ideological conflict being much bigger and having a sort of longer history. Would you agree that that's how Henry saw things in some sense? That because Graham was more, it seems that Graham became more political, more centered in the nation, and Henry didn't.
I think there's something to that. It partly has to do with access and the obvious influence that Graham was perceived to have because he was on television all the time and he was hosting these crusades, and reaching millions of people. It was obvious to people in Washington that he had an audience, I think, in a way that they didn't view Henry in the same way. I mean, most folks in the White House probably were, if they knew Henry's name at all, it was only in the vaguest, most passing way.
Right.
But I think you hit on something correct, and I think this is where George Marsden's insight from 30 years ago is bang on in his book about fundamentalism, which is that fundamentalists, and Henry was a recovering fundamentalist.
Yeah.
He remained a fundamentalist in so many ways. They see themselves as simultaneously insiders and outsiders, as the loyal core of the civilization, as well as the alienated sojourner who is never at home in his own culture, and that that tension in self-understanding persists, I think, in Henry's own understanding of America through through the last half of the 20th century and his attempts to reposition conservative Protestantism.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I bring this up is because I see this sort of theme running throughout your book that, and as a question I had, when evangelicals are trying to create or cultivate new generations of evangelicals, are they going to do it by saying this is for the benefit of the country? You can be you can find power through being trained to go out and to march against abortion, or is it that you can stand on sort of an intellectual tradition that dates back to, for Christians, the single most important moment in world history, and that alone is enough to make young evangelicals say, I have a purpose in this world. This is something that I need to dedicate my life to. But these are two, I think, fairly different draws or fairly different imperatives. One seems to be political, and it's the one that we often see when people talk about the religious right. And the other side, you see it as an imperative that has a much sort of longer history and that cuts across the different types of evangelicals in the United States. Does that sound about right?
That's very perceptive. I think that evangelicals have always been motivated by a call to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is something that people misunderstand about the Christian right when they cast the Christian right as this departure from an earlier history in which evangelicals and fundamentalists were all quietists who had no interest in affecting their surrounding society and were simply, waiting patiently for Jesus' second coming. Because if you look at the history, you see that there is a lot of continuity between the great moral reform movements that emerged from out of the Second Great Awakening, and the anti-communism and you know, anti-union agitation that we see someone like Dwight Moody involved in, yeah. You know, even after the supposed turn away from the world that it so often features in the potted history of fundamentalism,
right.
Someone like Carl McIntyre, the fundamentalist, you know, to end all fundamentalists,
right.
While he was endlessly critical of Billy Graham's collaboration with Roman Catholics in organizing his crusades, himself collaborated with Catholics in hosting anti-communist rallies.
Right, right.
And, you know, so he anticipated the moral majority by decades.
Absolutely.
Doing this in the
yeah.
40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And I do think, too, that you can see some impulse in this regard, this sense that Christianity is a calling to be Christian in the world. It's not just something that you do on Sundays, really across the spectrum of evangelicalism, from Mennonites to Pentecostals to one degree or another. But your second point about the degree to which evangelicalism is aware of its own history and, you know, like Catholics sees to root its young in an inherited tradition,
mm-hmm.
I think is a fraught one. Certainly, in general, evangelicals have, for most of their history since the Reformation, been primitivists, been decidedly ahistorical, and rather uninterested in the time between, you know, the apostolic era mm-hmm. and the founding of their own particular church, and see themselves as living and worshiping as Christ and his apostles did, and are decidedly resistant to the notion that they are historical creatures formed
right,
by
right.
centuries of history and their own surroundings, and whether they like it or not. But of course they are, as all humans are. And what I saw as I traced this contest over authority over the course of the past 70 years is that in some ways evangelicals reached a point of exhaustion simply fighting over the Bible via proof
right.
text
right.
and began to appeal to history and
absolutely.
Began to seek
yeah.
authority by asserting rival genealogies. I mean, you see this in the Southern Baptist Convention, for example,
mm-hmm.
as conservatives in that convention began to claim that this broad tent denomination that had historically been home to many different expressions of Baptist piety, ranging from very Arminian and revivalist to more cerebral and reformed, was actually a tradition in which there was one particular authentic way of being Southern Baptist, and that was essentially a reformed and deeply conservative, if not fundamentalist, way of being Southern Baptist. And in response to this, moderates asserted a different genealogy and claimed that, you know, they were the authentic Southern Baptists, and the conservatives were revisionists.
Right.
And you see versions of this also among the Lutherans, among the Pentecostals, all playing out really in the 70s and 80s, although it's part of a broader story. And today, we're seeing, you know, the next chapter of it as some younger evangelicals, exasperated with their parents' Christian right, eager to
right.
find their own way to a Christian identity, are rediscovering other parts, other strands of the evangelical heritage that perhaps they didn't grow up with, and are even reaching back further than that and trying to recover a connection to the early church fathers.
Yeah, I mean, this actually leads me to an area that we're both familiar with, which is the role that universities, you know, educational institutions play in sort of cultivating these questions. Because without a doubt, one of the best themes in the book are those parts you talk about Wheaton College or other universities, other Christian universities. I just find it fascinating to go through the machinations of the newspapers that these colleges and universities promoted, or the professors that came in and out of the classrooms there. Can you talk a little bit about the fundamental role that these institutions play in the story?
Yeah, yes. The higher education had to be the sphere that I engaged with at length, because it's really where so many of these questions play out
mm-hmm.
in an explicit way. And of course, evangelical higher education is very diverse.
Yeah.
And I try to give some sense of that by treating the Bible colleges as well as places like Wheaton,
Absolutely.
Which has a very different history. But I found that these institutions and the educators and administrators who ran them found themselves in very tight spots often, particularly in the wake of World War II, as the world of American higher education was changing rapidly. We know we have this influx of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of new students, many of whom funded by the GI Bill, with very different goals and ambitions than perhaps the students who'd come to these institutions in earlier decades had, and financial pressure, frankly, to really renegotiate the institution's relationship with the mainstream and become competitive, rethink questions like accreditation, while still balancing the institution's responsibilities to the expectations of parents and alumni, who often sent their kids to these schools so that they would be protected from the sins of the world. And I was, struck by the administrators at fundamentalist Bible colleges railing on the likes of Carl Henry as really barely orthodox in their letters, but in practice facing many of the same quandaries as Carl Henry and the neo-evangelicals did. Wheaton, in many ways, was ahead of the fundamentalist curve on these questions, and to some fundamentalist educators, a warning of what might happen if you let the liberal arts have too much sway. I became totally fascinated by, these back issues of the Wheaton Record, the student newspaper, or the literary magazine, and I did have to keep reminding myself that anyone who, who's on any university campus today knows that the newspaper, or certainly the lit mag, doesn't speak for all students and is often dominated by a kind of self-regarding vanguard, that is perhaps a little more radical than the norm. But nonetheless, I think that they did, they were at a useful, barometer of change. And I traced, the headlines and the content from the 40s when the Wheaton Record was full of, devotional material and rather parochial and really didn't see itself as a news outlet, into the more experimental 50s when the lit mag really starts to come into being, and the editors of the Record begin seeing themselves as serious reporters and curators of news. To the 70s when really in many ways the Wheaton Record was a forum for pushing the envelope in many ways. Yeah. One, perhaps my favorite story that I stumbled upon in the Wheaton archives is the story of Wesley Earl Craven.
I know.
Who, listeners may not know that the force behind the Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream films is himself a Wheaton College graduate.
Great stuff.
And he had a very dark, sort of offbeat sensibility even as a college student. Mm-hmm. And I read some of his college short stories, and they're not your typical Christian fare. They deal with, soldiers' experiences in wars and death and morally ambiguous situations. And he became editor of the literary magazine and announced very boldly, this is in, I want to say, 62, to readers that times were changing, that he was really, thumbing his nose at the Wheaton establishment, and he was going to publish stories that really forced readers to think about hard questions, and indeed did so, and received a flurry of hate mail. But the Wheaton Record editors came to his aid and gave him a forum to defend himself against his critics. But finally, after observing this and interfering far less than some of their colleagues would, the Wheaton administration did step in and yanked him from the masthead and forced the literary magazine back into a more predictable traditional vein. But Craven's story was perhaps an exaggerated example of a way in which this subculture of the student writers on these campuses were not always in lockstep, certainly, with their administrators. And in some cases, they had professors who were eager, usually in much less controversial, much less explicit ways, to encourage them to ask questions.
Exactly. That seems so interesting to me, because I think this is where, if I could bring up the sort of the topic, the intersection between religious history, biography, and intellectual history, where I saw it playing out in some interesting ways. Because clearly someone like Wes Craven is a product of some time, of some types of ideas that are being developed in a particular type of institution in an era in which the United States itself is changing rather radically. So could you talk a little bit about how you approached the idea? I mean, were you conscious that you were doing both types of history, religious and intellectual? And did it matter if you were conscious of that?
I think I was pondering this question, and I'm hard pressed to come up with an example of religious history that is not also
intellectual
history.
Right.
And I think one of the exciting things about this field right now is that the boundaries have really broken down, and we are seeing so much creative history coming forward because no one does intellectual history anymore without also doing something we might also call cultural history, simply casting a broader net. And while I would say most of my subjects are elites, because I was interested in the story of institutions,
right.
And these kind of thought leaders, I did try to push the stories, follow the stories of some of these ideas into the wider sphere, and talk about some of the great global spiritual renewal movements of the 20th century, like the charismatic renewal movement and the liturgical renewal movement, which are not typically included, church growth in the mission field, not typically treated in a standard history, theological history of evangelicalism in the 20th century. But to me, it's all of a piece. And, this has been my main concern with much of the current scholarship on the history of the Christian right, and that is that it's a story so often told as purely a political story, one of about backlash against the liberation movements of the 60s, or a continuation of anti-communism, or simply a story of knee-jerk racism and prejudice.
Yep.
And all of those things certainly play a role in the story, but to me it's also a story about ideas. And you can't understand Catholic and evangelical co-belligerence unless you consider the charismatic renewal movement, you consider changes in liturgy and the theological and spiritual detente between Protestants and Catholics that precedes moral majority.
Yeah, and what is it over? What do they agree on?
Well, I think they come to see one another as authentic Christians. That's one of the most profound changes that happens. And certainly, I don't want to exaggerate the degree to which old prejudices.
No, that's right. You're sensitive to that. Yeah, that's true. You're
change,
very sensitive.
Because of course, they continue to this day. But in the course of the charismatic renewal movement, this global Pentecostal revival that it's hard to date it, but probably we can say it began in the late 50s and began to taper off in the mid 70s. This swept both Protestant and Catholic communities, which had historically really considered tongues and prophecy and healings to be, something confined to apostolic times and blasphemous, or at least deeply, deeply questionable in our current time. But here, these Protestants and Catholics were seeing these phenomena with their own communities, and in many cases began to worship side by side at massive charismatic conferences. I found records indicating that the Catholic charismatic organization based at Notre Dame was funding Protestant charismatic meetings and other endeavors, and there was really quite a lot of collaboration. You start to see these neo-charismatic churches pop up that were attracting worshipers from both worlds, and I think the simple experience of worshiping side by side changes your view of someone you used to think was a disciple of the Whore of Babylon, right?
Absolutely.
And likewise, if you trace the institutional relationship of evangelical intellectuals and Catholic higher education, you see that there's this long history, really going back at least to the 40s, if not earlier, of even some of the most recalcitrant fundamentalist evangelical intellectuals grudgingly expressing admiration for the Catholic tradition of natural law and the Catholic ability to systematically rebut some of the challenges of secular modernity. And that admiration becomes quite explicit in the 80s and 90s as increasingly evangelical scholars and other intellectuals turn to Catholic institutions like Notre Dame, for example, support and funding, and, you know, flock to people like Robbie George at Princeton, who has loads of evangelical acolytes.
Yep.
And all of that is connected to the political cooperation that is a more familiar part of this story.
I mean, it's fascinating that you're linking up sort of the role, which I don't think I ever understood quite, the pivotal role that Notre Dame plays in this history from the 50s basically on, or Pew.
Right.
The money that Pew gives to young evangelicals, but also I think Notre Dame gets a lot of that money because of the program there. But then the charismatic movement, which on the face of it, I wouldn't think would have anything to say about the type of authority that you're talking about in the book. And yet you link the two things up quite nicely. What is that link? Why does Robbie George, someone who can speak to, in a sense, the people who are inspired by the charismatic movement?
Well, I think that it's sometimes hard to grasp it's hard to find the smoking gun sometimes that proves the presence of certain ideas or you know, causation rather than correlation. And I think many of the factors that I trace are kind of these ambient changes in evangelical culture, and you know, rather than sort of one-to-one causations, but I think that the connection is that the charismatic renewal movement did in this global way transform Protestant Catholic relations. And of course, you know, the changes in the Catholic Church in the wake of Vatican II are crucial to this. And Vatican II explicitly paved the way for increased collaboration between Catholics and evangelicals in things like Bible translation for missions, for example. So, you know, there's changes happening. It's not as if the Catholics are static at this time. But certainly a young evangelical growing up in, you know, your typical suburban evangelical megachurch in the 80s and 90s would have grown up with a different idea of Catholicism than, you know, his parents' generation did. And, you know, when he gets to college and he's looking for mentors, he would be more likely to see someone like Robbie George as a powerful guide and an ally rather than an agent of this hostile, you know, non-Christian church. And so, you know, and his worship experience more likely than not would have been shaped by a kind of soft charismatic spirituality that has pervaded evangelicalism. And frankly, you see it, you encounter it in the liberal mainline too, to some degree. You encounter, you know, not loud, aggressive, you know, speaking in tongues or rolling in the aisle, but rather a domesticated charismatic spirituality in which people often have their hands in the air and they're speaking quietly to themselves. And, you know, I think you're less likely to see the soft tongues in a Catholic worship, certainly, but you will see the hands in the air. You will see some physical echoes of the same spiritual expression. And this would not have been true, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Right. You know, There are some lines in your book that are so strong and you state things so clearly that I wanted to ask you a bit about them. There's a chapter on the gospel of liberation, which takes up the new evangelical left, which I think, as you know, until fairly recently, very few people really wrote about. But one of the things that I find interesting about the book is just the idea of the different varieties of evangelical. And if this book does nothing else, it is going to introduce a completely new sort of way of talking to talk about or to consider evangelicals in America. But you say something on page 197 about the new evangelical left. They were not interested in professing loyalty to any particular church tradition so much as conjuring an ideal and therefore imaginary image of the church as Jesus must have intended it. And I'm wondering, you know, this idea of the imagination, which is for me, it's such a it's elastic, but it's evocative, and I think the last section of your book, a lot of it has to do with this idea of imagining new ways to work across, you know, sort of ecumenically, new ways to imagine the world, new ways to imagine America. Can you talk a bit about that, about the role of imagination, sort of post 1960s?
Absolutely. Boy, you've read my book more carefully than I think anyone else has asked questions about it. It's wonderful. Well, I think, you know, you're the first quotation you mentioned about the evangelical left, you know, that's in the context of my effort to not portray progressive evangelicals as the flawless heroes who are exempt from all the critiques I levy against
the right.
more conservative evangelicals. Yep. I see them all as really wrestling with some of the same tensions that come out of this crisis of authority that I think has defined the movement for
right.
centuries. I suppose my use of the term the evangelical imagination is in part an effort to find a workable alternative to the term the evangelical mind,
right.
Which is certainly a neater term, and
yeah.
you know, it's one that's featured in the literature recently. And of course, my book is talking in some ways to Mark Knowles, the
right.
scandal of the evangelical mind,
mm-hmm.
Which made such huge waves among evangelical educators in particular, and I think was at one point required reading at Wheaton, if it is not still. But of course, the term the evangelical mind, while it is seductive, it has a nice ring, it implies this unity of purpose,
yeah.
of cognitive process that is simply not reflected in reality. And I suppose I liked the term imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is more elastic, because yeah. the concept of imagination is really what makes us human, and
mm-hmm.
it expresses the human project of using ideas, of absorbing ideas to transport ourselves somewhere else, to conjure a vision of what we might be, or to put ourselves in a position other than our own. And I think we are, this is, you know, one of the things, the main thing that separates us from other animals is our ability to think abstractly in this way. Not that other creatures aren't capable of empathy, but I think there's this abstract quality to imagination that makes it human.
Yeah.
And it's also a more dynamic word. It is unsettled. It evolves.
Yeah, that's right.
It responds to different experiences and resources. And there's room for internal conflict and contradiction, which to me is the main theme of evangelical
yeah.
history rather than unity.
I think it's really ambitious to set yourself up in that way, to spend at least, I would say, three chapters on this idea. I find those three chapters, I'll definitely assign them to some of my students when I do American cultural criticism, because I think some of the best stuff I've read about sort of recent American history. And the figure who comes through, who I've always been fascinated by in some of these chapters, is Francis Schaeffer, who I think Noel was quite influenced by Schaeffer, if I'm not wrong about that, if I'm not mistaken. But can you talk a bit about Francis Schaeffer and the role that he plays in some of this, in the creation of, in some ways, this paradoxical imagination?
Schaeffer is someone whose name I think was not particularly well known up until a few years ago, although now he's finally getting his due as one of the architects, the intellectual architects of the Christian right. He began his career as a Christian, as a fundamentalist Presbyterian,
right.
and went off as a missionary to post-war Europe with his family. And, you know, as many people now know, he accidentally, more or less, ended up founding this unconventional ministry called Le Brie, French for refuge,
right.
in the Swiss Alps, after his daughter began bringing home classmates who had questions about faith and the world and all these things. And he was forced to loosen some of his separatist fundamentalist notions about
mm-hmm.
interacting with the wider world, as increasingly, you know, bohemian backpackers and, you know, British drug addicts and evangelical college kids
right.
who were out to see the world and ask questions began spending the night in his home and asking these questions. And he became really a student of Western culture, tutored in large part by Hans Ruckmacher, who was a Dutch Reformed art historian, and began in the early 60s a series of really national speaking tours to evangelical audiences in America, And by this point, he understood himself as a cultural prophet whose calling it was to convince American evangelicals of their role in saving Western civilization. And he was a non-conventional orator. He had a kind of unpleasant nasal voice. His self-presentation was unusual. He was famous for wearing his knickers and Swiss knee socks.
Uh-huh.
But he offered this compelling narrative of really the decline of Western civilization. So it's roughly the era of Thomas Aquinas, who, according to Schaeffer, mistakenly elevated the authority of human reason over the Bible, and cascading on down and, you know, a kind of welter of war and misguided Renaissance philosophy, offering potted summaries of, you know, Leonardo da Vinci and, you know, Kierkegaard along the way, down across this terrible chasm that he called the line of despair, past which the Western civilization descended into our current state of, you know, bewildering and vulgar art, and the rise of anti-Christian, you know, secular humanism, and the general degradation of mores and order.
Yeah.
And he concluded with a kind of call to self-awareness, to evangelicals to really see themselves as charged with saving Western heritage at a time when thinkers on the left were abandoning the West in droves, were stripping curricular requirements in the Western canon from university course catalogs, and were associating the Western tradition with cultural imperialism. On top of this, Schaeffer could breezily offer these brief, confident summaries of, you know, Picasso and Camus, and, you know, give you in a few sentences a summary that left you convinced that you, as, you know, an evangelical who'd been made to believe you were an unschooled rube, a bumpkin on the outside of a serious intellectual life, could understand these things.
Yeah, yeah.
He was not all that political, really, initially, but was radicalized by Roe versus Wade because he saw abortion as the nadir that he had so long predicted, and he deserves a lot of the credit for mobilizing evangelicals to take action against legal abortion at a time when it was mainly a Catholic issue.
Right.
And he did so by appealing to ideas and history and convincing evangelicals that they were part of this centuries-long story.
I was going to say, whether or not his history was correct or even complicated or sophisticated in any way, he does create this sort of imaginary past for evangelicals to completely buy into.
Impressive. I compare him to Oswald Spengler.
In
Spengler's ability to explain the great cultural and political tragedy of World War I to Germans.
Yeah.
I mean, Schaeffer is doing something similar. He's explaining to evangelicals how America of the 60s and 70s became so screwed up in their view.
Yeah, so this leads us to maybe the final question for you is so much that has been written about evangelicals or the Christian right starts with the categories defined by the culture wars. And you get to this particular period, of course, at the end of your book, and it doesn't dictate how you look at evangelicals. Can you give us an idea of how we should think about the culture wars in relation to evangelicals and maybe in relation to the fights over the fights within Christianity in general?
I think the culture wars are a product of the outcome of a particular culture war within evangelicalism.
Okay,
that's
great.
The victory of one particular strand of evangelical Protestantism over others in the public face of evangelicalism and in the shaping of the political platform of many of the most influential organizations associated with the Christian right.
Yeah.
The reason why the culture wars can be a limiting framework is because it encourages us to take that one strand of evangelicalism for the whole.
Right.
And so the story I try to tell is one of both how that happened, how this particular largely reformed intellectual tradition came to exercise such outsized power, but also the way in which other evangelicals have contested it and how they have worked to assert a different heritage and a different argument for what constitutes authentic expression of Christianity in culture and a Christian's role in politics.
It's great stuff, Molly. Yeah, thank you so much for for speaking with us today, because this is it's a great book, and I think that unlike a lot of books out today, this is it's not just comprehensive, but it has great character sketches. And I think for people who are looking for models of how to do this sort of integrated book of biography and intellectual history and cultural history and religious history, this is a really good example. So thank you so much for speaking with us. You've been listening to New Books in Intellectual History. That was an interview with Molly Worthen, assistant professor at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and her new book, Apostles of Reason. I'm Ray Herbersky. Thank you for listening.